I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Good evening. Drones, drone killings especially. The Obama administration, following the Bush administration, is struggling with language, legal understanding of when targeted killings are acceptable conduct. Within these last days, the former general counsel at the Department of Defense for the Obama administration, Mr. Jay Johnson, speaking in New York, has talked about how there is a vacuum that needs to be filled with law and precedent and argument, not just about targeted killings under the writ that given by Congress in conflict zones, but those at the edges of conflict zones, or in Africa, for example, or targets of opportunity that present themselves for non-combatants or men who are not recognized as part of a nation state or another military. Michael Vlahos, who teaches at the Naval War College, the views here are his own, writing most recently for a forthcoming volume, Nationalism, War, and Sacrifice, Dying for One's Country, coming from the Library of Social Science, looking at drones and the very idea in America of retributive justice. We'll begin with drone talk in general. Michael, a very good evening to you. When is a drone killing acceptable, and when is it not? Do you sense that the American public, in addition to the professional military, and you teach professional military, are struggling with this idea right now? Is this a fresh doubt in the American people? Good evening to you.
Good evening. It's not fresh. It's actually, and deeply buried in the American psyche. And that issue is, of course, whether or not such killings are a problem at all, and to what extent they are sanctioned, not that they are not sanctioned. So the issue for Americans really grows out of the foundation, the legitimating firmament, if you will, that sanctions America's killing of others and of its own citizens. And here, we really have to go way back before drones to the original sanctioning agency, which emerges out of America's central tenet of faith. The core passion of American civil religion is what we call American exceptionalism. And American exceptionalism identifies America truly as a chosen people, but not simply Israelites, but chosen as an agent, if you will, of God to fulfill his mission to humanity.
John Winthrop, on board Arbella, sailing in the 17th century, we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. Please continue, Michael.
Well, we say these things, or we mention Winthrop, and we mention Mather, and we mention the Puritans, and we mention American exceptionalism in this past campaign. Republican presidential hopefuls intoned it as though it were almost a mantra, something out of, a series of rosary prayers. And yet we don't really examine what we are so sacrally invoking. The truth is that this mission from God is not merely a sacred trust, but in the way that we conceive it, it is a high expectation. In other words, we are expected to achieve or to fulfill God's plan on earth to redeem humanity. And the truth of the matter is, in recent years, going back to 1945, the United States has failed three times. Now, remember, the U.S. succeeded in redeeming itself in the Civil War, right? We were corrupt, and we redeemed ourselves in this tremendous bloodletting full of sacrifice and self-redemption. Well, in World War I, we failed, but we came back in World War II, and in 1945, we were on the very cusp of achieving everything, the millennium. And we failed. There was a Cold War, but then we won the Cold War, or so our narrative tells us. We won the Cold War, and yet after that, we let everything slide. And then, came another opportunity in 9/11. 9/11, which was a kind of a terrible psychic blow on one hand and had all sorts of dark implications of the fall of the city, meaning the fall of the great American enterprise. We could turn that around and flip it so that it became suddenly an opportunity to rescue and redeem humankind, to transform the Middle East, as George Bush said. This was our true purpose in the war. This is what we set out to do. And we all know it, or should know it, and better yet, we can all call it back on the Internet anytime we want and listen to all the things we said about how we were going to do just that. But yet we failed, and we understand now on the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq how greatly we failed. So the problem here is what happens when the United States of America fails to fulfill God's plan on earth. And this is where I believe the issue of retributive justice comes into play. In other words, where you go and slay evil, where redemption of humanity, a kind of altruistic mission at its very purest, is set aside, and we enter into the dark path, go down that shadowy road of slaying evil things as our main task. How does that happen? Because, in effect, what I believe is the emphasis now on drones, which succeeded the emphasis of the previous administration on simply killing bad guys, the term of art of the time. This focus on killing evil, of slaying dragons and, in effect, the devil himself, has heavily, completely, wholly replaced what had been perhaps fragile, but nonetheless the jewel in the crown of our mission, our efforts, everything we were doing way back after 2001 was to save the world. Now it is to kill evil. And so what we need to think about is how drones then fit into this larger need that we have, and then to ask ourselves why and how long this urgent motivation will continue, and finally, how strong the sources are that allow us to basically tell ourselves that we are the highest authority for initiating such deep sanctioning next to God, that we are the highest authority on earth and that we can go and kill people anywhere on earth, including American citizens, because of this incumbency we have from the divine.
I'm speaking with Michael Vlahos of the Naval War College, and we're looking at drones because, and I will put it into the vernacular, these robots are doing our bidding to kill without justice, without transparency, without due process. Michael points to the Civil War as the first of the efforts of the Americans to recapture their mission, the city upon a hill. And I remind you all, Lincoln's second inaugural address, talking about how far we will go in order to recover our perfect world. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled up by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. That's Abraham Lincoln at his most scolding. When we come back, here in the 21st century, are we on a mission? Are we killing with purpose? I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Michael Vlahos is here. And while the Obama administration seeks careful language about the targeted killings now being conducted by drones, and after all, recall now, these are robots in the sky, but they're being directed by a human being probably on an Air Force base, although some of these are paramilitary drones. That would be the CIA. Some of them are special forces. That would be in in an army base, perhaps in North Carolina. How, and the killings now, what is the purpose? Are we recovering our mission, the city upon a hill, all eyes upon us, or are we just cutting our way through an enemy, an arbitrary enemy, and we're coming to no good end? Michael, I want to turn the possibility that our retributive justice is creating monsters who will come for us. Right now, there's reason to believe that everybody who's rained upon by the Hellfire missiles from the Predators is going to practice revenge. Are we creating the next level of terror?
Well, I think you've already given us a powerful aperture on this possibility with your eloquent quote of Lincoln at his most stern Calvinist fire and brimstone self. Because Lincoln talking about retributive justice is the counterpoint we don't typically get today when we go to the movies and see Daniel Day-Lewis and see Lincoln at his most, heartbreaking, Christ-like, redemptive self. And so this tension that you can see even in the person of Lincoln between the stern Calvinist Old Testament biblical fire and brimstone man on one hand and of Christ on the cross on the other, I think tells you about what the tension is within America itself. And so what I posit in my paper is that the United States, when it feels that it has failed as God's agent, that it seeks to regain its place with God through the exercise of retributive justice. That retributive justice is a way of clawing back to a place where then America is in a position of some ease and luxury to then re-embrace the redemptive vision that is, it's obviously from ancient sources, its final objective. So that what the U.S. did during the Bush administration in trying to kill bad guys, and then effectively what this new administration, no longer new, but the Obama administration has been doing in its own way, is very similar, if not identical, and that is to try and kill enough evil so that America then has the opportunity to return to this sort of magisterial embrace of the good and the elevation of humanity. The problem, of course, is that, and this is the great concern that I have, is that we may have, going down this dark path of retributive justice, we may reach a point where we become actually comfortable in killing people we don't like, and in doing so set up, as you just identified, a kind of tit-for-tat vendetta relationship with much of the rest of the world. And then as the rest of the world begins to take their own retribution on us, we only accelerate and intensify the way in which we try to punish evil, and evil is multiplying. And in a world of multiplicative evil in the dark parts of humanity, we then have an enormous task without end. And in that situation, we would, without ever realizing what we're doing, because we're not able to articulate any of the deep stuff that's going on here about ourselves, we will just get sucked into a new framework of American ethos, and the whole idea of redemption will be lost. And this is a problem that's intensified by the fact that we so failed to achieve the kind of uplifting of the Iraqi and Afghan people.
We're frustrated, Michael.
And the Arab Spring didn't work out, and we're ready to say, to hell with you.
And I press you, Michael, with the night we entered Baghdad, you told me we're all Arabists now. And yet at the same time, in being Arabists, we're at the we're at the border of that. We're watching this happen. It is possible. I just come to this after listening very carefully for 10 years now to our Arabism. It is possible that we're foils in the transformation of the Ummah, and that the Ummah is the next wave of governance. Our empire can be lost in the history books now if we continue to punish without purpose.
Well, this is the course I feel that we're sliding into without being aware of it. You know, and when I said we're all Arabists now, I was projecting my own desire and what I wanted to see and what I was trying to do myself. And after, you know, 200 or 300 speeches to defense audiences, I realized that this was never going to happen, that there was no way in which we could develop the kind of understanding and empathy of that world that would allow us to help change happen there, that we were going to cling to empire until it slid away or was wrested from our bloody hands. And that's, in effect, what's happening. And so we're left unable to acknowledge defeat and yet trying desperately to find some way to salvage a shred of honor out of this terrible and disheartening experience. So the surge was one element of salvaging honor. And I think now what we're doing with drones is saying, well, to hell with all of this. We're just going to kill them. And we're really good at it, and it's working. And in the process of doing that, we're setting up the grand vendetta, the U.S. and the rest of humanity, or the U.S. and its few select friends versus whatever the other world is, of the other people, of the strangers, of the alien. And this is the path of American decline. There's no American decline economically or militarily. The decline in America that is the greatest threat to our identity is the decline of the American idea.
Because we're losing our sense of our mission here, Michael.
Yes, we're losing our sense of ourselves.
Yes.
This is an endless path downward as a spiral. This happened to the French during the French Revolution. Now, this isn't a revolution, but when you start killing the thing that is you, in the case of the French, it was the idea of liberty, egality, fraternity. Well, if we kill the vision of redeeming humanity, which is actually who we are in many ways, we're finished. We then become just another killer dominant society.
We have a minute, Michael, so I will come to a very simple question right now. Have we got time to reverse this?
Oh, we have time.
Yeah.
But that time is not available for use. And it's not available for use because all of the things that I've said and tried to convey center on one critical factor that Americans can't seem to grapple with.
And 20 seconds, Michael. Go ahead.
Self-recognition. We can't see who we are, and thus we can't save who we are if we can't see who we are.
Michael Vlahos of the Naval War College, and Michael and I are both reflecting on the drones, not the legal part of the drones, but why we're using them, why we're killing strangers, and how that killing is transforming us. Michael is writing in the For Nationalism, War and Sacrifice volume, Dying for One's Country, from the Library of Social Science. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Springtime, and the birds return to the north temperate zone, and it's a pleasure to welcome them, but we need more information about how it is they've survived these last 100 million years, including the period of time where the asteroid comet struck the Yucatan Peninsula and wiped out the dinosaurs. We understand that birds and dinosaurs are cousins or related in some fashion, but how is it that the birds did so well and the dinosaurs are in the movies? Sid Perkins for Science Now is here to start us on our spring tour of evolution and what it teaches us about the next time an asteroid strikes. Sid, a very good evening to you. It hadn't occurred to me that birds could lay more eggs than they do. They do lay, and I'm waiting for the robins to come back, and I've set a bird's nest up, hoping that I'll have a family to watch this springtime. But I learned from you that there's a new study, thanks to the development of fossils found in northeastern China, that demonstrates that 125 million years ago, birds went through an important transition or evolution with regard to their ovaries. How so?
Well, this is a study of fossils, as you say, from northeastern China about 125 million years ago, and this shows that early birds were quite intermediate between their closest dinosaur relatives and modern birds. Fossils, you know, all of them, one of them is from a pigeon-sized, long-tailed bird called Jihol ornis, and the other two were a bird somewhat larger than the sparrow. They don't know the species because the bones weren't quite well-preserved. But each of those fossils apparently preserves an ovary that includes follicles of maturing eggs. And like modern birds, which only have one functional ovary, these appeared to be located on the left side of those birds' bodies. And they went through their analysis. They showed that they weren't seeds because they weren't located in the part of the body where the stomach contents would typically be found. And they're also not what's called gastroliths or gizzard-like stomach stones because they weren't preserved as three-dimensional rocks. These things were originally soft tissue. So what they're looking at is, again, these things being ovaries with maturing egg cells in them. And these finds provide a host of clues about reproductive biology in these birds. One fossil, you know, the bones in the hand or the outer part of the wing weren't yet fully formed, fully fused. So this is a hint that females of the species were sexually mature before they were fully grown. One of the fossil ovaries had at least 20 follicles ready for ovulation, which is a sign that birds laid large numbers of eggs in a single clutch, which is unlike most modern birds. And then that, in turn, provides clues about parental care in these species. The fossil record shows that the closest dinosaur relatives also laid large numbers of eggs at once and had males that tended the nest and cared for the hatchlings, and a few modern-day birds that lay large numbers of eggs at once, including things like ostriches and emus. The females lay eggs in several nests and leave child care to the males. So the presumption is that these birds did as well.
The one ovary, Sid, I did not know that birds had one ovary, so I'm learning that, but that's modern birds. This dates one ovary 125 million years ago. Do dinosaurs have one ovary, or as you say, this is a transition between dinosaurs and birds?
This is an intermediate because the closest dinosaur relatives, you know, fossils of them show that, that preserve soft tissue, those rare occasions, show that they had two functional ovaries and they laid large numbers of eggs. So the presumption is that the loss of one functional ovary, particularly so early in bird evolution, probably related to the development of flight. Having only one functional ovary likely would have rendered egg-laden females significantly lighter and more maneuverable in flight.
So it's an evolutionary.
Some scientists are saying that it could have even helped some lineages of birds survive that mass extinction
right.
In the wake of the asteroid impact, as you said.
So what we're looking at is sort of if we talk about aerodynamic design in the 20th and 21st century, you make the craft lighter so it can fly higher and faster. You go from metal, steel, to aluminum, to composites. And that's what evolution is doing. It says we don't need two ovaries. If we have one, it'll be lighter and we can fly better. And then we can still preserve our species by having birds able to sexually be active even before they're mature so they can start laying eggs right away. I'm not quite sure about the males sitting on eggs. Is that an evolutionary development or is that just incidental to this?
Well, it's just incidental. It's one of those things where if the females can lay a lot of eggs at once and have, you know, numerous groups take care of them, then
right.
You're more likely to have, you know, faster reproduction rates overall.
Right. Bachelor father early on. And the speculation that this permitted This allowed the birds to survive the asteroid comet strike of 66 million years ago, actually 66 million and some change. This is because flight allowed them to travel and avoid the damage to the forest so that they could find food elsewhere besides the burned out zones.
It could have been that. It could have been related to parental care. It could have been kind of a host of things. Again, if you're reduced to a small population and you have a fast reproduction rate, your population can spring back much more quickly and survive an insult that a more slow-breeding creature could not.
All right, the birds are back for springtime, but now the camels. I don't think of camels as springtime. I think of them, of course, as wonderful creatures in Bob Hope and Bing Crosby movies wandering across on the road to Morocco or Algeria. But right now, I learned from Sid writing in Science Now that camels, you think of them as Sahara beasts or Indian beasts. Camels, in fact, very likely prospered in the north, in the Arctic zone, what is now Ellesmere Island and the Bering Strait. But these are giant camels. How big, Sid?
They are, you know, based on the analyses of the fossils these folks have found, about 30% larger than modern camels. That puts them up in the 900-kilogram moose size range. They were a little under 9 foot tall at the shoulder.
And we think that's where camels come from, that they started there, and then what we have now in the Middle East is a watered-down version 3.5 million years later.
Well, actually, they didn't start out there, but they certainly lived there for a while. The first known ancestors of the camels actually evolved in North America about 45 million years ago. And today, they only live in those hot, arid regions stretching from North Africa to Central Asia. And in between then and now, of course, they had to get from where they started out to where they ended up. And part of that trek included land bridges and life at very high latitudes. These fossils that I wrote about, they're 30 bits of bone, none of them larger than 3 inches long. They come from a 3.4 million year old layer of gravel, as you mentioned, on Ellesmere Island. And these bones were very fragmented. They, you know, several ice ages had come and gone and scoured the island since these creatures had lived there. And even today, you've got these seasonal freeze-thaw cycles that continue to splinter bones into ever smaller bits. But from what was remained of this creature was very small scattered bits, but the size and shape of those bone fragments suggest they came from a tibia, which is a lower leg bone. But alone, those fragments were so fragmentary you couldn't really tell the species or even the group of mammal they came from. But what these researchers did was they went beyond just looking at the fossil and their size and shape and looked at the genetic analyses of the collagen proteins that were preserved in the bones and compared to proteins, you know, found in living species. The closest living relative was the dromedary camel.
Right, the artiodactyl group, which includes, I learned from Sid, deer, cow, and camels. Now, about the temperature. Ellesmere Island is cold. In fact, it's very cold today. But from the research that you publish, it was much warmer 3.5 million years ago, 18 degrees centigrade warmer than modern temperature. So even though it was northern latitude, I'm presuming, 3.5 million years ago, the continents pretty much look like what they look today. There clearly was a profoundly different climate on the Earth.
Absolutely. The current annual average temperature up there is about 3 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, and then the average annual temperature at the time, you know, 3.5 million years ago, was around 29 degrees Fahrenheit, which is below freezing, but as you mentioned, quite a bit warmer than it is today. And fossils of that were taken from another site, 10 kilometers away from where these camel bones were found, shows that the environment was an open forest. It was kind of punctuated with peatlands. It was inhabited by bears, rabbits, beavers. There was a greyhound-sized miniature deer, and there was a pony-sized three-toed horse. It was, you know, lush compared to what it is today, of course.
Now, springtime wouldn't be right without the birds and the bees. Camels are welcome, too. And you've published a science now piece that shows that bees don't need eyes. They have what? An ability to maneuver and find flowers entirely using their electronics. How so?
Well, this is just another one of those senses that, you know, animals have that humans don't. They can see ultraviolet light. They can, you know, smell much better than humans. Now, this research shows that these bumblebees can use electric fields. When they're flying, static electricity builds up on the bees, you know, due to their flapping wings. It's very much like shuffling across a carpet, and, you know, flying actually gives bees typically a positive charge. Flowers, on the other hand, typically have a negative charge, and then that difference between the bee and the flower is what helps transfer pollen to the bees, among other things. And now new research suggests that these bees can actually get information from the electric fields of flowers. What these researchers did in lab tests, they taught the bees how to distinguish artificial flowers with sweet liquids and one type of electric field from, you know, ones that had bitter fluids and a different type of electric field. So what they showed was that bees are keenly tuned into these electric fields, and the idea is that bees use them in the real world out in nature as well. And, you know, just as people who've charged up after shuffling across a carpet can give up a spark when they touch a doorknob, you know, bees charged up from flying, when they light on a flower, they will partially neutralize its electric field. So, you know, bees coming behind it, you know, the flower can provide an electric field, gives bees a hint that they've actually been landed on recently, and maybe there's less pollen or nectar there. And the idea is that bees learn from experience not to land on flowers where they might be disappointed.
Sid Perkins for Science Now. It's springtime, the birds and the bees and giant camels. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. You will all recall the legend of the whale, not Jonah and the whale, but the whale that grew and grew as a trader. This is 2011-2012. Until the spring of 2012, there were these odd revelations in major news reporting that there was a position held by one particular man, his name turned out to be Bruno, in London, that was now so large it was changing the nature of the market. What was he holding? Well, these are odd derivative scale opportunities, but let's just put it this way. This is the stuff that was supposed to go away after the crisis of 2008-2012. This last year and more, Carl Levin, retiring from the United States Center from Michigan, has been leading a one-man and one staff campaign to find out what the whale was all about and why what at one point was a $500 million paper loss during the trading turned into a $6.2 billion so far loss for J.P. Morgan Chase, the best of the best of the banks too big to fail. Jesse Eisinger is here for ProPublica with some revealing remarks about what was learned from the whale and this giant tempest in a teapot. That's a quote from Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, the best of the best of the banks too big to fail. Jesse, first of all, I enjoy the way you've very keenly underlined the fact that Carl Levin is a one-man investigative team. He's the Wyatt Earp of the banks. Do you believe that he's gotten into all of the dark corners here? You've looked at his report. You've watched the testimony. Are you satisfied that Levin did the thoroughness that this needed? Good evening to you.
Investigating all sorts of things, and they've been particularly good on financial fraud, much better at bringing some of these practices to light than either the Department of Justice, the SEC, or even the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, in my opinion.
And what we find here, and there are lots of intricacies to the regulators, what did they know and when did they know it, and also the revelations in the media, what we find here is that it's very difficult to believe that everybody didn't know everything while it was going on. What's your opinion, Jesse, of the way Carl Levin reported this affair?
Well, I think that they didn't grasp everything, but I think that they seem not to have been entirely candid in public remarks, particularly a public call with shareholders and the public on April 13th, where the CFO, Doug Brownstein, and Jamie Dimon, when Jamie Dimon famously said this is a tempest in a teapot.
Right.
My reading of the Levin report is that they had a lot of information at hand to know that this was quite a disaster brewing, and there was a lot of motivation for them to be misleading, and their remarks were misleading. Now, whether they were knowingly lying, I don't think we have evidence of that yet, but I think they were deeply misleading, and it's pretty shocking that, as you say, this bank that had the best reputation for not only managing risks, but for being upstanding and honest, really doesn't seem to have held that reputation through the whale incident.
I'm told, Jesse, and I'm an amateur at this, that they were trading their own money, and that's okay. But isn't it also true that J.P. Morgan Chase and other banks too big to fail have the opportunity to use taxpayer money if they get in trouble? So even though they claim it's their own money, we're backing them up?
We are deeply subsidizing the biggest banks in this country, not only explicitly through deposit insurance, through the FDIC, but there are all sorts of implicit subsidies to people who lend to banks, to the bankers themselves, primarily through the backing of the Federal Reserve. So these institutions are highly protected institutions by our government, and because of that, there's a rule now that's being formulated post-Dodd-Frank that says you cannot trade for your own profits using these kind of this money that's backed ultimately by taxpayers. And the reason is obvious. It's that if they win, they get to keep their profits and distribute them as bonuses or dividends to shareholders. If they lose, the taxpayer has to fork over the money to cover the losses. This is a dangerous situation and obviously encourages them to take wild bets because they have no downside. And we were supposed to ban this kind of thing post the financial crisis. And the regulators have been working on this for 2.5 years now, over 2.5 years, to try to finalize what's called the Volcker Rule to ban this activity. And they still haven't figured this out. So it is a activity that should be banned. It may be banned, but so far it is not quite banned yet.
Ina Drew was the head of the unit that where the whale operated, the so-called CIO, did lose her job, and there are statements to suggest that she was trying to mislead investigators or regulators at the time. But I note that Douglas Brownstein, who was chief financial officer at the time of this storm, and Jamie Dimon, clearly the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, they have not lost their jobs. You do note that they took a pay cut 1 year. Is that it? Is that what the punishment is for the big bosses when they lose $6 billion?
Yeah, there's very little punishment. They, Brownstein went from about $10 million a year down to $5 million a year. I don't know about you, but I think I probably live on $5 million a year. I might have to cut back on, some wine or something. But these guys don't feel the kind of pain that the average American feels when he or she loses a home. It's obviously the case. It was a measure of accountability at J.P. Morgan, but it only went so far. Jamie Dimon took a pay cut, too, and he certainly has suffered some embarrassment. But the fact is that these guys do not suffer any serious consequences. They don't get banned from the industry. They don't. They can lie to the regulators. They can mislead the regulators, the public. And they can misrepresent what their assets are worth. And the regulators have a very hard time figuring this out, understanding whether they're actually being misled, and then doing anything about it. And it's a bizarre state of affairs. It's a dangerous state of affairs. And it's untenable. We can't have the largest banks in this country being completely impervious to regulation and being immune to prosecution.
Jesse Eisinger for ProPublica on the whale so far. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.